Salutations, sports nerds. It's time for another episode of War on Hot Takes, powered by Capital News Service. I'm Adam Zalanka, and with me as always is Dylan Sin. Remember, you can find us on Twitter at War on Hot Takes, and we're also on SoundCloud and at cnsmaryland.org. We have a jam-packed show for you this week, as you might have expected, so thank you for tuning in.
That's right. We'll talk Capitals hockey, where Alex Ovechkin has gotten off to an historically hot start, and we'll get you ready for Week 6 in the NFL, as the surprisingly 3-2 Ravens take on the Bears, and Washington faces off with the winless 49ers. We'll also have our fellow CNS reporter Connor Hoyt of the Washington Bureau on to talk playoff baseball.
But first, we have so much to catch up on this week about your Washington Nationals, who have now forced a Game 5 with Chicago Cubs here in Washington Thursday night. But wait, before we even get that far, we got to take this in chronological order. I know Dylan has 1,000 things he wants to say about this series, being the Chicagoland Cubs fan that he is, and you know he is. But let's backpedal a little bit. The Cubs are up 2-1. It's almost time for Game 4, but it's a rainy day in the Windy City. And Dusty Baker is asked about... How does this go, Dylan? Do you want to just jump in here?
Yeah, so it's an incredibly complicated situation. First, Dusty was asked who's going to start Game 4, and he said that because Steven Strasburg had thrown a bullpen on Tuesday in anticipation of starting Game 5, therefore you don't normally throw a bullpen 2 days before your start. So he threw the bullpen Tuesday, means he'd start Thursday Game 5 if it happened. Tanner Roark was going to start Game 4. Then it was reported through several outlets that Strasburg had actually thrown a bullpen on Monday, which would set him up to start Wednesday, obviously. It was misleading at best, let's put it that way.
Gives it a misleading on the chart here of factcheck.org.
Right. So Dusty then was asked, so why isn't Strasburg starting? He was asked again. He said Strasburg, along with several other players on the team, is what he called under the weather. And he blamed mold in Chicago. He said, quote, a lot of my team is under the weather with the change of weather, air conditioning, hotel. This is the time of year for mold around Chicago. That is a direct quote from Dusty Baker.
Hashtag mold.
Right. That fueled 24 hours of rampant speculation that Steven Strasburg did not want the ball in Game 4 for whatever reason. You know how social media works with this. The rumors just took off. And it ended up being a moot point because Game 4 was rained out on Wednesday, moved back to Thursday. Strasburg said he felt better on Thursday, and so he started the game, and wouldn't you know it, he went out and pitched like Cy Young reincarnated. He was absolutely incredible, Adam.
Tuesday was the game that was rained out and moved to Wednesday. You said Wednesday and then Thursday earlier. Today's
you're right. You're absolutely right.
It's tough. We usually record this podcast on Wednesdays, but we waited between this and hockey. We wanted to wait for Thursday morning to put it all together. And it's been fantastic. By the way, you know we're called War on Hot Takes because we wage war on hot takes. And while this has nothing to do with stats, please, everybody on Twitter, reconsider. The next time you have some vicious stomach bug, how would you feel about pitching against a major league team in that condition? Just think about that. Think about the expectations on professional athletes to perform at the highest level no matter what's going on in their life, no matter if their wife is giving birth to their first child or if they've got mold in their whatever. I don't know. I personally don't think it was mold. I think that that's just the window dressing for this hilarious 24 hours of speculation before Game 4 actually happened. But yeah, take your hot takes somewhere else. This is not the place for that. Take your hot takes away from us. It's great that Strasburg got to pitch. Not great for Dylan. It's terrible for Dylan. It's great for the Nats that Strasburg did get to pitch this Game 4 in Chicago Wednesday, because if it were going to be played on Tuesday, it sounded like it was going to be Tanner Roark. And you know you want the ball in Tanner Roark's hand, right? When it's an elimination game and your game's on the line. Let us talk about the actual game yesterday. Nats win 5-0 to force a Game 5 here in the district. Strasburg had 12 strikeouts and 7 scoreless innings. Is that right, Dylan? Do you remember?
That's exactly right. And like I said, he was absolutely incredible. Adam was just talking about take your hot takes somewhere else. If we had an inner monologue on Steven Strasburg yesterday, every time he recorded a strikeout, that's probably what he was saying to himself, because he was absolutely incredible. ended up 7 shutout innings, 12 strikeouts, absolutely baffled the Cubs the entire time, and his changeup was absolutely incredible right at him.
It was filthy. It was filthy. The hot takers do want to, I always go back to them, but they do want to say it looks like the best pitch in baseball, but there's stats to back that take up, because he threw 32 changeups yesterday in his 7 innings and got Cubs to swing at 15 of them. There were 15 swinging strikes, I should say, specifically. That's nearly 50% of getting a swing and a miss. 50% doesn't sound that impressive, but take a second and think about that. These are major league players, and once it starts working, they're supposed to expect it, just like Jason Hayward was supposed to expect it at that one point.
Right. You bring up a great point. In the 7th inning, it was Strasburg's last inning, and he'd struck out the first 2 hitters on changeups. And Jason Hayward comes up, he's batting .400 against Strasburg in his career. That's why he was in the lineup yesterday. And he gets to the count is full, and he had to know the changeup was coming. Strasburg was going to throw the changeup. He threw the changeup, dove down out of the strike zone, would have been ball 4. What do you know, Hayward swung and missed. It's so difficult for these hitters to pick up the changeup because Strasburg also throws 97, and you have to be ready for that. And the changeup is thrown from the exact same arm slot, and it looks like the exact same pitch until it darts down out of the strike zone and they swing over the top of it every single time. The Cubs' 2 best hitters are Chris Bryant and Anthony Rizzo. Yesterday combined, they went 0-for-7 with 6 strikeouts. Bryant, the 2016 NL MVP, went 0-for-4 with 4 strikeouts. It was just a masterful performance.
Incredible. It's incredible. And Strasburg became the 3rd pitcher in baseball history. The division series, we know that that playoff expansion hasn't been around for a long, long time. But in baseball history, he's become only the 3rd pitcher to have 2 games in the same series where he pitches 10 or more strikeouts in each game. Last guy to do is Justin Verlander in 2013 in the ALDS. In fact, Strasburg is the first National League pitcher to achieve this, and he's the first National League pitcher to do this in any kind of postseason series since Bob Gibson did it in 1968 in the World Series.
My dad would be so excited that we were talking about Bob Gibson here. Bob Gibson was my dad's favorite pitcher when he was a kid. But you said the 1968 World Series. 1968, of course, the year of the pitcher when they literally lowered the pitcher's mound after the season because the pitchers were too good, and Strasburg did something this year that hadn't been done since then. That's just an incredible feat.
I hope Dylan's dad should be listening, right? Hi, Mr. Sim. It's good to talk to you.
Hi, Dad.
You also mentioned Bryant and Rizzo, a combined 0-for-7. All these games in the series have been low scoring in one way or another. Most of the Nats' runs come off one swing of the bat with Michael A. Taylor, who we haven't even brought up yet, hitting his grand slam to make it 5-0 after most of the game was a 1-0 affair. The Cubs, no runs. Bryant and Rizzo can't get on base if they can't make contact with the ball, for goodness sake. Then the Cubs are in trouble. Now, let's spin this forward, Dylan, to Game 5 tonight, again, here in the district. We're excited. I know Dylan's excited, and everybody in our office here at Capital News Service, who's, you know, they're all Nats fans. Everybody else here is a Nats fan. I am the impartial observer, and you should really listen to me more than anybody else because of my lack of rooting interest on either side. Okay? But it's Nationals and Cubs Game 5. Dylan, what do we got? It looks like Kyle Hendricks has been named already the Cubs starter.
Yes, yes.
What about for Washington?
For Washington, it will more than likely be Gio Gonzalez. They're trying to draw it out a little bit. They might start Tanner Roark. It's a little bit of gamesmanship. But more than likely, it will be Game 2 starter Gio Gonzalez making his 2nd start of the series. And it's a testament to how much Steven Strasburg and Max Scherzer have shut down the Cubs that they're actually probably a little bit relieved to see Gonzalez, who they scored 3 runs off of, with a couple homers in Game 1. Rizzo hit one, and Wilson Contreras hit one. But Gonzalez is no slouch himself. Here are some stats on him from this season. He was 5th in the National League in ERA, 6th in wins, had the fewest walks of any qualifying pitcher in the league, was 7th in walks plus hits per innings pitched, and 6th in innings pitched. That is the pitcher the Cubs are, quote-unquote, relieved to see. That's not a direct quote, but that's what I'm assuming is going through their heads, because it's not Scherzer or Strasburg.
You just quoted yourself from a minute ago in the podcast.
Quote myself. That is some meta stuff that we're doing here.
Gio Gonzalez is an underrated pitcher because of the fact that he gets lost behind the Nats' great 1-2 punch of Strasburg and Scherzer.
He's the number 3 pitcher on the staff, but
he'd be a number 1 on half the teams.
Many teams, exactly. And so it'll be another tough game for the Cubs. Gonzalez's curveball was working very well in Game 1. The Cubs' off-speed pitches, they've swung and missed it a bunch from this series, not just Strasburg's changeup. They've really struggled. And so they'll probably bring out their right-handed heavy lineup Albert Almora, who hit .342 during the regular season against lefties, yeah, and had a single off lefty reliever Solis in game three for the game tying hit, will be in there. Javier Baez will be in there. One guy who will probably not be in the lineup is Ian Happ, who took a very circuitous route to the ball on Michael Taylor's grand slam yesterday. He kind of stumbled around out there before the ball landed in the basket. He will probably not be in the lineup. So we'll see whether the Cubs are able to get some early runs against Gonzalez. And if they don't, it's going to be a very long day for the hitters, because it's going to start to feel like, wow, we can't hit anyone.
And to continue this conversation, we talked to this man a few weeks ago. Connor Hoyt, our CNS colleague, will join us now to continue the talk about Game 5 tonight. Connor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
What have you seen, not just in Wednesday night's game, but the first four games of this series?
Well, I've seen an anemic Nats offense coupled with some of the most unbelievable playoff pitching that I've ever seen. Strasburg and Scherzer have obviously been lights out, and the fact that the Nats have only won one of those three starts is mind-boggling to me, because the general vibe that I'm getting from the series is it's not necessarily who's outperforming the other team. Instead, it's who's going to get that timely hit in the eighth inning. All these great starting efforts are just going by the wayside because it'll be a scoreless game or a low-scoring game, and then there's one big hit, or in the case of Rizzo, there's one bloop hit, and it completely changes the tide of the series. So if that's the kind of baseball you like, then this is the series for you, I guess.
We talked about fielding independent pitching the last time you were on, the three true outcomes, and a lot of the one kind of that three true outcomes, strikeouts, has been happening a lot when Strasburg gets on the mound.
Yeah, no kidding. He had 12 of them yesterday, just 7 innings of work, and it was an efficient 7 innings, just over 100 pitches.
106, I
106,
believe.
106, yeah. And he had his changeup working. In his last inning of work, he struck out Zobrist, Russell, and Hayward, back-to-back-to-back, all on changeups. It's a completely reinvented Strasburg right now, because when he first broke into the league, he was very much reliant on that high 90s fastball, mixing it in with a curveball, which is a great setup, sure, but I'm of the mindset that a well-placed and a well-timed changeup is the best pitch in baseball, and now that it seems like Scherzer's figured that out, Strasburg, rather, we've seen him live up to that number one pick billing.
Now, moving forward past Game 5, let's look at the NLCS for a second. Your Los Angeles Dodgers are already in that series. As a Dodgers fan, you know that that team will be facing either Washington or Dylan's Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
So, first let me pose, assuming the Nats win Game 5.
It's a big assumption.
Big assumption. Assuming the Nats win Game 5 over Dylan's terrible Cubs, how do you see the Dodgers matching up, especially against Washington's lights-out pitching?
Early reports would show that Strasburg won't be available until at least Game 3, which mm-hmm. would be the following Tuesday in D.C., I would assume that Scherzer would be set to start Game 2. So from there, I think the key for the Dodgers is to win Game 1. They've been resting. Kershaw hasn't pitched since last Friday. So they have their rotation set. They have that luxury. And they can almost just play things by ear. I mean, Dave Roberts hasn't announced his rotation at all yet outside of Kershaw for Friday. So depending on what happens on Friday, then, you know, we could see the Dodgers trot out Darvish or Rich Hill on Saturday, see how things go. But I will say, Adam, that Nationals rotation is very top-heavy. So I think the Dodgers, if they want to win that series, just like Arizona, they may have to win both games at home. Because you come back to D.C. and you bring out Strasburg, and all of a sudden the Nats steal one in Los Angeles, then you have Strasburg and Gio ready to go in D.C., and all of a sudden that series looks like it's tipping in the Nats' favor. So the Dodgers need to pounce, and they need to pounce early, because that rotation at the top, at least the top three, it's dominant.
It's daunting, yeah. And now, for the sake of my co-host Dylan Sin, let's swap in the Cubs for the Nationals. If we're looking at the Washington bowing out, and it's LA versus Chicago, the arguably best team in baseball versus the World Series defending champions in the NLCS, that'd be an exciting series too. Anything different than what you just said there? A lot
yeah.
of wait and see?
I mean, it'd certainly be different. Obviously, we've got the whole narrative of the rematch, and I'm sure the Dodgers would be anxious for revenge. I just read they had to wait 30 to 45 minutes after last year's Game 6 to get out of Wrigley, just because it was such a wild scene there after the game. And Understandably so. Like, it had been, I mean, what, they were in the World Series? 1945,
so it had been 61 years since the last pennant for them.
So, it makes sense, but obviously as the loser in that situation, you can't help but feel a little bitter. Outside of the narrative, Dylan and I were just talking about this earlier, the Cubs are a deep team. And so, while they may have to exercise that whole rotation within the past 2 days just to get out of the first round, and they may have to defer to Lackey on Saturday, outside of that, I mean, they're four main starters in Lester, Hendricks, Quintana, and Jake Arrieta. That's a pretty formidable top four right there. And while none of those pitchers necessarily jumps off the page and scares you to the point where you just don't want to see them, they're all solid pitchers, and you could conceivably get 6 to 7 innings out of them, avoid that bullpen meltdown that has plagued the Cubs, and then you go to Wade Davis for an inning plus, and all of a sudden the Cubs are a scary team.
The anxious tension between the Cubs fan and the Dodgers fan in the room, while not stated, I feel it so much. You might even be coming across those listening, just, it's in the air. It's playoff baseball. Pitching is always the best part about playoff baseball, because the teams with the best pitching always are the best teams. You need it. You need it more than ever when it comes to October. Dylan, I won't shut you out of the segment. You need any rebuttal against what Connor has said?
No, I think Connor's exactly right. It's going to be very important. The Cubs are a very deep team, and you said John Lackey, he hasn't started in this Nationals series, so on short rest, he might be the guy that gets the ball in game one. He's a seasoned pitcher. He's won a couple of rings in his career, so he's the Cubs' nominal number five starter, but that's a guy you like out there on the mound. So that really shows you how deep this Cubs pitching staff is. I mean, the Dodgers have, obviously, Kershaw and Darvish and Alex Wood and Rich Hill, and that's very deep too, but I'd take the Cubs against anybody.
Mm-hmm. The only issue with Lackey is if he gets too deep into a game, is Joe Maddon going to have to wrestle the ball out of his hands?
Right, exactly. That's happened before. Lackey does not like coming out of the game when Joe comes to take him out.
So whether it's Dodgers-Cubs, or for probably the majority of our fan base is more likely hoping for Dodgers-Nationals, first we got to get through Game 5 Thursday night. I hope you've enjoyed this deep segment. Connor, by the way, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, that's enough baseball for now. I don't want Dylan to blow a vein on his neck thinking about all the permutations here. So instead, we're going to turn to Alex Ovechkin and the Washington Capitals. What a first week for their season. We'll break that down coming up.
Hello, welcome back to War on Hot Takes. We're going to get into some Capitals talk now, early season hockey action. And obviously, early in the season, the biggest story, as it often is for the Capitals, is the play of Alexander Ovechkin. Last year, more often than not, it was, what's wrong with Alexander Ovechkin? He only scored 33 goals, which for most players is, some of them will be a career season. But for Alexander Ovechkin, it was kind of a disappointment. This year, he is already a quarter of the way there. Through four games, Ovechkin leads the NHL with 8 goals. He's tied for the lead in points with teammate
Evgeny Kuznetsov.
Evgeny Kuznetsov. Yeah, thank you for helping me with that pronunciation, because I butcher names.
Yeah, we don't want to butcher hockey names. Dylan, and everybody listening right now, I want you to think about 100 years. That's a long time ago. 100 years ago was 1917. We had not yet concluded World War I 100 years ago. So when I hear that something happened in sports, some sort of stat was achieved for the first time in 100 years, that always, without fail, blows my mind. And that's precisely what happened to open this NHL season. Less than a week after we brought up Ovechkin's offense on last week's podcast, he opens with 7 goals in the first 2 games, hat-trick followed by hat-trick in the Caps' first 2 wins of the year. And he became the first NHL player in 100 years to open a season with consecutive hat tricks. I just think that's, Dylan, I'm at a loss for words. That blows my mind.
To be perfectly honest, I'm just glad that there's something that we can talk about in sports that happened 100 years ago other than the Cubs winning the World Series. So okay. To me, that makes me happy. But yeah, it is an incredible stat. Ovechkin has gotten off to an amazing start. And sorry, I want to talk about something other than the Cubs right now.
Dylan always wants to bring it back to the Cubs.
Well, not right now. It was a rough game.
we see the Washington starts with 2 wins, starts really hot, beating Ottawa in their first game in a shootout, final score 5-4, and then taking care of Montreal easily, 6-1. But since then, It's been a couple of losses. They lost to Tampa Bay Lightning in overtime, got a point out of that, final score of 4-3. And then last night, Dylan, while everybody was watching the Nats game, and in fact, even certain hockey reporters were pointing out that people in the arena were watching the Grand Slam on their phones and cheering in the middle of the hockey game, we had Capitals hosting the hated rival Pittsburgh Penguins for the first time this season. It's first of four meetings of these teams in the regular season, and inevitably they'll find each other in the playoffs, we know that. But Washington couldn't pull it out on Wednesday and lost 3-2.
Right, and the first time they've played each other, these two teams, since Game 7 of the semifinals in the playoffs last year, so it probably brought up some demons for the Capitals to lose that way again. They really struggled, especially with penalties last night. There was six times the Penguins went on the power play, and three times they scored.
So all three of their goals.
So that was pretty much the game right there, and that's something that when these teams play again later in the season, the Capitals are really going to have to clean up.
On the positives for the Capitals, not only did Ovechkin score his eighth goal of the year last night, Christian Juice, the rookie defenseman, gets 2 points, a goal and an assist. To go back to Ovechkin, we talked a bit last week about how Barry Trotz was going to be using him a lot more on the second line with center Evgeny Kuznetsov rather than the first line so that he could split up first line center Nicholas Backstrom and Ovechkin to try to make coaches work and make a tough choice of who they're going to put their best defenders on. It's kind of working so far, because like we said earlier, not only is Ovechkin leading the league in goals, Evgeny Kuznetsov has 8 assists and leads the league in assists, and they are tied for the NHL lead in 8 points apiece through this first week of the season. Now, small sample size. I mean, that might as well be the subtitle of our podcast, is check the sample size on that. But Dylan, it seems to work this early in the year. It seems like it's working.
Exactly. And an important point is that Backstrom himself hasn't really suffered with Ovechkin moving to the second line either. Backstrom has 6 points himself, a goal and 5 assists. And so it seems like splitting them up has really been a good strategy for the Capitals. We'll have to see whether that continues, whether teams figure out a way to counter and start splitting up their first and second lines to counter the dominance and the balance that Washington has showed early in the season.
One other great note to remember, we don't want to let the podcast go by without mentioning this. Nathan Walker, the first Australian officially now to play a game in the NHL, in his debut against the Montreal Canadiens on Saturday, scored a goal as well. He gets his first goal in his NHL debut. Our own colleague here, Chase Pike, did a great profile on him, which it's not too late to read if you go find it on cnsmaryland.org. We'll also put the link on our Twitter account, @WarOnHotTakes. Check that out. He's quickly becoming a fan favorite if you ask Chase or if you ask a lot of people around hockey. The first Australian in NHL history gets his first goal really early in the season. As far as going forward, the Caps have a quick road trip up I-95 corridor this weekend. They play the New Jersey Devils, my New Jersey Devils, on Friday night. I get a team. You know? They won some cups. That's all I can claim. At New Jersey on Friday, followed by at Philly, my other hockey team. Don't ask me why, that's a long story. On Saturday, Caps will return home by playing the Toronto Maple Leafs on Tuesday the 17th. So, want to wrap it up now, and we're going to be right back here on War on Hot Takes.
Hello, welcome back to War on Hot Takes. We're going to get into some NFL talk now. It is already week 6 of the NFL season. The season is flying along, and we're going to start with the Washington NFL team, talk a little bit about them first. This week, the 49ers come to Washington along with their conquering hero coach, Kyle Shanahan, recently the offensive coordinator of the NFC champion Atlanta Falcons, whose team is now 0-5. He is looking for his first victory as coach of the San Francisco 49ers, and it's been a long season for the 49ers already.
It's been a long season, and Kyle Shanahan, of course, everybody here is familiar with his time as four-year offensive coordinator under his dad, Mike Shanahan, for the Washington NFC East professional football franchise. He's been an offensive coordinator for four teams, Dylan, starting with Houston Texans for two seasons, 08 and 09, before Washington. In 2014, he spent a year with Cleveland Browns. When you're a coach of at any level in Cleveland, you last 1 or 2 years tops. So he was only there for 1 year before going to Atlanta. And yes, everyone knows that in 2016, the Falcons had the best offense in football and the number one scoring offense in particular during the regular season. But what I found that's pretty interesting, Kyle Shanahan is hailed as this offensive mastermind from time to time, but he's been up and down in terms of production in 9 years in a row that he's been an offensive coordinator. What I mean by that is I looked back to 2008 through last season, and the offenses he has been in charge of, more often than not, are in the bottom 10 in the NFL in scoring offense than they are in the top 10. He's had Houston 2009, they were 10th in scoring. Washington 2012, the rookie year of Robert Griffin III, the year that they won the division, they were 4th in scoring. And Atlanta last year led the league in scoring. But 3 of the 4 times that his offenses have been in the bottom 10 in the league in scoring have been with Washington. Start with 2010 when he started. Washington was 25th. 2011, he was 26th. 2013, the year that he and his dad were fired, 23rd. The year after that in Cleveland, 27th. If you put your finger on 1 year, it's more likely that you will find a year Shanahan coordinated a bad offense, scoring-wise, than a good offense. Now, can't blame all of that on the coordinator, because in the case of when you have to coach a quarterback like Rex Grossman or an aging Donovan McNabb at the start of his tenure here in Washington, you can't really spin straw into gold every time. So you give him the benefit of the doubt. And it's not necessarily his fault that his Niners right now are 0-5 as he tries to bring together Brian Hoyer, Carlos Hyde, former Washington player, wide receiver Pierre Garçon is there. There's a lot of these connections that we'll be talking about for this game between these two teams. But Dylan, as far as these 0-5 teams go, who do you think is worse, Cleveland, the Giants, or the 49ers?
Well, it seems like Cleveland and the Giants, it's been a weekly struggle. Every single game they've been not exactly blown out, but they've looked overmatched on the field, and that hasn't been exactly true for the 49ers. But over the last 4 weeks, they've lost by 3 points, 2 points, 3 points, and 3 points.
It's amazing, right? We think of them as, oh, they still can't get off the schneid, get in the win column, but they've been competitive against some teams like Seattle. Actually, they've played every division opponent once already, Arizona, LA Rams. Colts are not so good, but you're supposed to be competitive in that. This is not a team getting blown out.
No, exactly. And we've talked about this in baseball segments before, and the same thing holds true in the NFL, is that in close games like that, there's really not a lot of skill to winning those games. In the very close games, you're going to finish about 500 over the course of a long season or over the course of a larger sample size. So this is something that will likely even out for the 49ers as the season goes on. They're not going to keep losing, more than likely, close games forever. So if Washington wants to get to 3-2, they're going to need to try to run away with it this week.
Want me to do the player to watch for Washington now, and then we'll move on?
Absolutely, yeah. Who is our player to watch for Washington this week?
Twitter told us to do Vernon Davis. We gave you 3 options this week for Washington for our Twitter poll. You can find this every week around Tuesday. We put it up at War on Hot Takes, just as it sounds, spelled normal. You know, come find us, come follow us. We had, at the time of this recording, 100% votes for Vernon Davis. And I'm glad, because of all of the San Fran Washington connections to talk about, my favorite is Vernon Davis, who was born and raised in the Washington metro area. He's a UMD Terp, University of Maryland, and he was drafted in the top 10 by San Francisco at the beginning of his career. He made a long career with the Niners. But what's fantastic is Davis is having now a bit of a second wind. Don't want to call it much of a career renaissance, but 2 years ago, the Niners traded Davis to Denver Broncos midseason, and he didn't stick there very long, but then joined Washington in the following free agent period. Now, on a team with Jordan Reed, you don't expect the second tight end to get a ton of production, right? But this year, Davis has been the more productive tight end than Reed. Jordan Reed has been targeted 19 times and has caught 14 balls. Both of those numbers a little higher than Vernon, but Reed has had 105 yards and he's yet to find the end zone. Reed's played 3 games, by the way, and Davis, although I believe he did play in the first game, wasn't targeted, and all of Davis's production has come weeks 2, 3, and 4. We're looking at the same sample size of 3 games for each dude. Davis, although he's been targeted less, he's caught 8 of his 9 targets. He's gone 160 yards already and a touchdown, including in week 4, something like a 65-yard catch. And again, he's found the end zone. He's averaging 20 yards a catch, which is way higher than Reed's 7.5. And he's on pace now, Davis, to eclipse his yardage total from last season, his first in Washington, of 583. He's on pace for already somewhere in the mid-600s right now. My favorite thing, though, is this is going to be the first time Davis plays against the 49ers. So in those kind of things, when Peyton Manning first went against the Colts, you know he's played all 31 other teams in the league by then. So I think this is probably that cap moment for Davis, and he gets them to come to him in his backyard. I predict, and we don't do predictions much, I predict Davis is going to have a pretty darn good game, Dylan.
That would be nice for him. You know, the more you know, Davis is only 33 years old. I was not aware of that. We looked it up before the show, and he is only 33. It seems like he's been in the league forever, but at this point, it looks like he still has a few more years left in the tank. And he really has been a very reliable safety blanket down the field for Kirk Cousins. This is something that was not expected, and it's a new dimension that Washington has added to their offense, even as Jordan Reed has been pretty unproductive.
So you want to move from Washington up the BWI Turnpike to Baltimore? Talk about the Ravens?
That sounds great to me. The Ravens, despite all the criticism that we've leveled against them this year, all of which has been justified, the Ravens are 3-2. They are coming off a 30-17 win over the Oakland Raiders, and they will take on the Chicago Bears and their rookie quarterback, Mitchell Trubisky.
Yay!
This coming week, we'll talk about my Bears in just a little
bit. Dylan's Bears. Exactly. Dylan's Cubs and Dylan's Bears.
I claim the Cubs a lot more than I do the Bears right now. The Bears are really struggling, but we'll get into that in a minute. What I do want to talk about is the Ravens' offensive line, because this week against the Raiders, the offensive line was, I believe, and I think the stats bear it out, the key to victory for them. And Pro Football Focus did an analysis of NFL offensive lines this week and found that the Ravens' offensive line graded out as the fourth best in the entire league, which obviously is huge, especially with Joe Flacco struggling so much. And one stat that I thought is really instructive of that is that the Ravens' running backs average 2.1 yards per carry before contact. So before a tackler even touches them, they've already gained 2.1 yards past the line of scrimmage. So, and that's completely on the offensive line. Now, this week especially against the Raiders was very impressive because Joe Flacco was pressured on only 11.5% of his dropbacks this week. So the Ravens are improving in pass blocking as well. Now that 11.5% ratio was second in all of football this week. And it's doubly impressive against a Raiders team that came in ranked 9th in the league. In that stat, they get pressure on the quarterback almost 30% of the time entering the Ravens game. So it's a Raiders team that was very good on the defensive line. Khalil Mack and Bruce Irvin both struggled. Khalil Mack had no disrupted dropbacks. He didn't get pressure on Joe Flacco at all. Meanwhile, Bruce Irvin had no solo tackles for the first time since joining the Raiders in 2016. Now, those are two prime-time defensive linemen, and the Ravens completely took them out of the game. And that is what allowed Flacco to have his best game of the year. He averaged 8.5 yards per attempt. He had an 85.7 QBR, which, as much as we've criticized Joe Flacco, and rightly so, for most of the year, he had a great game. And it's that offensive line that really allowed him to do that.
The most important thing is that Joe Flacco finally went a game without throwing an interception. He had a streak of 10 or 11 games going there of at least one interception or more. And if you're not getting pressured, you have more time to make the right decisions. And good for Mr. Elite, Mr. Flacco, getting off the schneid in that way, too, against a Raiders defense that I thought was better than we've begun seeing lately. But to your point, the offensive line from Baltimore manhandled them. And this is also, by the way, without their best offensive lineman, Marshall Yanda, an all-pro guard, because he got hurt early in the year, right?
Right. Marshall Yanda has been out. He's six-time Pro Bowler and has been out since week 2 with a broken ankle. He is out for the season. And what makes it even more impressive was that this week against the Raiders, the guy who is filling in for Marshall Yanda, his name is Matt Skura. He was the right guard. He went from the practice squad to the starting lineup when Yanda got hurt. So he left the Raiders game with a sprained knee, and in came Jermaine Illuminor, who was a fifth-round pick this year. No one really expected him to play all that much, and now he is the starter going into this week, and he is our Ravens player to watch this week. Okay. Jermaine Illuminor is the right guard. Keep an eye on him because, obviously, as we just talked about, the offensive line is hugely instrumental. If Flacco has time to throw, he is capable of being successful. Big part of keeping the offensive line at the level it's been is Illuminor becoming a part of that offensive line quickly. And now, he was a fifth-round pick out of Texas A&M. Pro Football Focus, when they were grading him before the draft, they said that he is best in a conservative run-blocking scheme. So it'll be interesting to see whether the Ravens try to run the ball more, throw less, to kind of accommodate him, because obviously you would expect him, in at least in his first NFL start, to be something of a weak link. But we'll see if that proves to be the case.
We'll see. They're playing, again, the Chicago Bears.
And rookie quarterback Mitchell Trubisky. A lot of Chicago was a little bit probably preoccupied after the Cubs' victory over the Nationals in Game 3, but Mitchell Trubisky did have his debut the same night. It didn't go quite as well as that Game 3 for the Cubs. Trubisky was under 50% completion percentage. He threw a costly interception that cost the Bears the game at the end. wasn't exactly a stellar debut, but from what I saw, and this is not a statistical take, but from what I saw, there were a few throws that Trubisky made where you can see the talent. You can see why the Bears said this is going to be the guy that comes in and is our franchise quarterback. He has a very strong arm. He's incredibly accurate, and it's really decision-making that is going to be the issue for him as he grows, and so we'll see if the Ravens can force him into some bad decisions this week.
I will point out that when the Ravens played a rookie quarterback week one, DeShone Kizer, they picked him off 5 times.
The Bears are slightly more conservative. Hugh Jackson really threw a lot at DeShone Kizer in week one, and I think John Fox is going to try to work...
got Jordan Howard in there a lot.
Exactly. They're going to try to work Trubisky in and kind of not put a whole lot on his plate right away, and we'll see whether that proves to be more effective, but it's definitely something to watch for.
Seriously, run Jordan Howard. If you're listening, I'm telling you, I need my number one fantasy running back and my second round pick to play like one, okay?
We don't stump for our fantasy teams on this show very often, but in this case, Adam has been agonizing over Jordan Howard and his lack of production this season. So if you're listening, John Fox, let's get Jordan Howard some carries.
We've had a lot of fun here today. Guys, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Stay away from mold this weekend. Oh, visit us on Twitter. We should say that.
And we should
visit
say that.
Us on Twitter. Go to cnsmaryland.org. Please, thank you, and goodbye.
See you next week.